Chapter 23. The End. Sir James Ovington's carriage was waiting without, and in the Tiavon family, so tragically separated, and so strangely reunited, were borne away to the squire's hospitable home. When they had gone, my uncle mounted his curricle, and drove Ambrose and myself to the village. "We had best see your father at once, nephew," said he. "Earl Lothian and his man started some time ago. I should be sorry if there should be any hitch in our meeting. For my part, I was thinking of our opponent's deadly reputation as a duelist, and I suppose that my features must have betrayed my feelings, for my uncle began to laugh. "Why, nephew," said he, "you look as if you were walking behind my coffin. It is not my first affair, and I dare bet that it will not be my last. When I fight near town I usually fire 100 or so in Manton's back shop, but I dare say I can find my way to his waistcoat. But I confess that I am somewhat accable by all that has befallen us. To think of my dear old friend being not only alive, but innocent as well. And that he should have such a strapping son and heir to carry on the race of Avon. This will be the last blow to Hume, for I know that the Jews have given him rope on the score of his expectations. And you, Ambrose, that you should break out in such a way." Of all the amazing things which had happened, this seemed to have impressed my uncle most, and he recurred to it again and again. That a man whom he had come to regard as a machine for tying cravats and brewing chocolate should suddenly develop fiery human passions was indeed a prodigy. If his silver razor heater had taken to evil ways, he could not have been more astounded. We were still 100 yards from the cottage when I saw the tall, green-coated Mr. Corcoran striding down the garden path. My father was waiting for us at the door with an expression of subdued delight upon his face. "Happy to serve you in any way, Sir Charles," said he. "He have arranged it for tomorrow at 7 on Ditching Common." "I wish these things could be brought off a little later in the day," said my uncle. "He has either to rise at a perfectly absurd hour, or else to neglect one's toilet. They are stopping across the road at the Friar's Oak Inn, and if you would wish it later, no, I shall make the effort. Ambrose, you will bring up the batterist at toilet at 5. I don't know whether you would care to use my barkers," said my father. "I've had 'em in 14 actions, and up to 30 yards you couldn't wish a better tool." "Thank you, I have my dueling pistols under the seat. See that the triggers are oiled, Ambrose, for I love a light pull. Ah, Sister Mary, I have brought your boy back to you, none the worse, I hope, for the dissipations of town. I need not tell you how my dear mother wept over me and fondled me, for you who have mothers will know for yourselves, and you who have not will never understand how warm and snug the home nest can be. How I had chafed and longed for the wonders of town, and yet, now that I had seen more than my wildest dreams had ever deemed possible, my eyes had rested upon nothing which was so sweet and so restful as our own little sitting room, with its terracotta dash-colored walls, and those trifles which are so insignificant in themselves, and yet so rich in memories, the blowfish from the Moluccas, the narwhal's horn from the Arctic, and the picture of the Kaira, with Lord Hotham in chase. How cheery, too, to see at one side of the shining grate my father with his pipe and his merry red face, and on the other my mother with her fingers ever turning and darting with her knitting needles. As I looked at them, I marveled that I could ever have longed to leave them, or that I could bring myself to leave them again. But leave them I must, and that speedily, as I learned amidst the boisterous congratulations of my father, and the tears of my mother. He had himself been appointed to the Cato, 64, with post rank, whilst a note had come from Lord Nelson at Portsmouth to say that a vacancy was open for me, if I should present myself at once. "And your mother has your sea chest all ready, my lad, and you can travel down with me tomorrow. For if you are to be one of Nelson's men, you must show him that you are worthy of it." "All the stones have been in the sea service," said my mother, apologetically to my uncle, "and it is a great chance that he should enter under Lord Nelson's own patronage. But we can never forget your kindness, Charles, in showing our dear Rodney something of the world. On the contrary, Sister Mary, said my uncle, graciously, your son has been an excellent companion to me, so much so that I fear that I am open to the charge of having neglected my dear Fidelio. I trust that I bring him back somewhat more polished than I found him. It would be folly to call him distinguished, but he is at least unobjectionable. Nature has denied him the highest gifts, and I find him averse to employing the compensating advantages of art. But, at least, I have shown him something of life, and I have taught him a few lessons in finesse and deportment which may appear to be wasted upon him at present, but which, nonetheless, may come back to him in his more mature years. If his career in town has been a disappointment to me, the reason lies mainly in the fact that I am foolish enough to measure others by the standard which I have myself set. I am well disposed towards him, however, and I consider him eminently adapted for the profession which he is about to adopt. He held out his sacred snuff box to me as he spoke, as a solemn pledge of his goodwill, and, as I look back at him, there is no moment at which I see him more plainly than that with the old mischievous light dancing once more in his large intolerant eyes, one thumb in the armpit of his vest, and the little shining box held out upon his snow-white palm. He was a type and leader of a strange breed of men which has vanished away from England, the full-blooded, virile buck, exquisite in his dress, narrow in his thoughts, coarse in his amusements, and eccentric in his habits. They walk across the bright stage of English history with their finicky step, their preposterous cravats, their high collars, their dangling seals, and they vanish into those dark wings from which there is no return. The world has outgrown them, and there is no place now for their strange fashions, their practical jokes, and carefully cultivated eccentricities. And yet behind this outer veiling of folly, with which they so carefully draped themselves, they were often men of strong character and robust personality. The languid loungers of St. James were also the yachtsmen of the Solent, the fine riders of the Shires, and the hardy fighters in many a wayside battle and many a morning frolic. Wellington picked his best officers from amongst them. They condescended occasionally to poetry or oratory, and Byron, Charles James Fox, Sheridan, and Castlereagh preserved some reputation amongst them, in spite of their publicity. I cannot think how the historian of the future can hope to understand them, when I, who knew one of them so well, and bore his blood in my veins, could never quite tell how much of him was real, and how much was due to the affectations which he had cultivated so long, that they had ceased to deserve the name. Through the chinks of that armor of folly I have sometimes thought that I had caught a glimpse of a good and true man within, and it pleases me to hope that I was right. It was destined that the exciting incidents of that day were even now not at an end. I had retired early to rest, but it was impossible for me to sleep, for my mind would turn to Boy Jim, and to the extraordinary change in his position and prospects. I was still turning and tossing when I heard the sound of flying hoofs coming down the London road, and immediately afterwards the grating of wheels as they pulled up in front of the inn. My window chanced to be open, for it was a fresh spring night, and I heard the creak of the inn door, and a voice asking whether Sir Lothian Hume was within. At the name I sprang from my bed, and I was in time to see three men, who had alighted from the carriage, file into the lighted hall. The two horses were left standing, with the glare of the open door falling upon their brown shoulders and patient heads. 10 minutes may have passed, and then I heard the clatter of many steps, and a knot of men came clustering through the door. You need not employ violence, said a harsh, clear voice. And whose suit is it?
Several suits, sir.
They yelled over in the yokes that you'd pull off the fight this morning. Total amounts is £12,000. Look here, my man, I have a very important appointment for 7 o'clock tomorrow. I'll give you £50, if you will leave me until then.
Couldn't do it, sir, really.
It's more than our places as sheriff's officers is worth. In the yellow glare of the carriage lamp I saw the baronet look up at our windows, and if hatred could have killed, his eyes would have been as deadly as his pistol. I can't mount the carriage, unless you free my hands, said he. Old Ard, Bill, for he looks vicious.
Let go one arm at a time.
Ah, what do you then?
Corcoran. Corcoran. Screamed a voice, and I saw a plunge, a struggle, and one frantic figure breaking its way from the rest. Then came a heavy blow, and down he fell in the middle of the moonlit road, flapping and jumping among the dust like a trout new landed. He snapped at this time. Get him by the wrists, Jim. Now, all together. He was hoisted up like a bag of flour, and fell with a brutal thud into the bottom of the carriage. The three men sprang in after him, a whip whistled in the darkness, and I had seen the last that I or anyone else, save some charitable visitor to a debtor's gal, was ever again destined to see of Sir Lothian Hume, the once fashionable Corinthian. Lord Avon lived for 2 years longer, long enough, with the help of Ambrose, to fully establish his innocence of the horrible crime, in the shadow of which he had lived so long. What he could not clear away, however, was the effect of those years of morbid and unnatural life spent in the hidden chambers of the old house, and it was only the devotion of his wife and of his son which kept the thin and flickering flame of his life alight. She whom I had known as the play actress of Anstey Cross became the Dowager Lady Avon, whilst boy Jim, as dear to me now as when we harried birds' nests and tickled trout together, is now Lord Avon, beloved by his tenantry, the finest sportsman and the most popular man from the north of the Weald to the Channel. He was married to the second daughter of Sir James Ovington, and as I have seen three of his grandchildren within a week, I fancy that, if any of Sir Lothian's descendants have their eye upon the property, they are likely to be as disappointed as their ancestor was before them. The old house of Cliff Royal has been pulled down, owing to the terrible family associations which hung round it, and a beautiful modern building sprang up in its place. The lodge which stood by the Brighton Road was so dainty with its trellis work and its rose bushes, that I was not the only visitor who declared that I had rather be the owner of it than of the great house amongst the trees. Therefore many years in a happy and peaceful old age lived Jack Harrison and his wife, receiving back in the sunset of their lives the loving care which they had themselves bestowed. Never again did Champion Harrison throw his leg over the ropes of a 24-foot ring. But the story of the great battle between the Smith and the West Countryman is still familiar to old ring-goers, and nothing pleased him better than to refight it all, round by round, as he sat in the sunshine under his rose-girt porch. But if he heard the tap of his wife's stick approaching him, his talk would break off at once into the garden and its prospects, for she was still haunted by the fear that he would some day go back to the ring, and she never missed the old man for an hour without being convinced that he had hobbled off to wrest the belt from the latest upstart champion. It was at his own very earnest request that they inscribed, "He fought the good fight," upon his tombstone, and though I cannot doubt that he had Black Bank and Crab Wilson in his mind when he asked it, yet none who knew him would grudge its spiritual meaning as a summing up of his clean and manly life. Sir Charles Tregellis continued for some years to show his scarlet and gold at Newmarket, and his inimitable coats in St. James. It was he who invented buttons and loops at the ends of dress pantaloons, and who broke fresh ground by his investigation of the comparative merits of a singlet and of starch in the preparation of shirt fronts. There are old fops still lurking in the corners of Arthur's or of White's who can remember Tregellis's dictum that a cravat should be so stiffened that three parts of the length could be raised by one corner, and the painful schism which followed, when Lord Alvanley and his school contended that a half was sufficient. Then came the supremacy of Brummel, and the open breach upon the subject of velvet collars, in which the town followed the lead of the younger man. My uncle, who was not born to be second to anyone, retired instantly to St. Albans, and announced that he would make it the center of fashion and of society, instead of degenerate London. It chanced, however, that the mayor and corporation waited upon him with an address of thanks for his good intentions towards the town, and that the burgesses, having ordered new coats from London for the occasion, were all arrayed in velvet collars, which so preyed upon my uncle's spirits that he took to his bed, and never showed his face in public again. His money, which had ruined what might have been a great life, was divided amongst many bequests, an annuity to his valet, Ambrose, being amongst them. But enough has come to his sister, my dear mother, to help to make her old age as sunny and as pleasant as even I could wish. And as for me, the poor string upon which these beads are strung, I dare scarce say another word about myself, lest this, which I had meant to be the last word of a chapter, should grow into the first words of a new one. Had I not taken up my pen to tell you a story of the land, I might, perchance, have made a better one of the sea, but the one frame cannot hold two opposite pictures. The day may come when I shall write down all that I remember of the greatest battle ever fought upon salt water, and how my father's gallant life was brought to an end as, with his paint rubbing against a French 80 gunship on one side, and a Spanish 74 upon the other, he stood eating an apple in the break of his poop. I saw the smoke banks on that October evening swirl slowly up over the Atlantic swell, and rise, until they had shredded into thinnest air, and lost themselves in the infinite blue of heaven. And with them rose the cloud which had hung over the country, and it also thinned and thinned, until God's own sun of peace and security was shining once more upon us, never more, we hope, to be bedamed. End of the Project Gutenberg e-book, Rodney Stone. RDST 1 Sir Arthur Conan Doyle by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Gutenberg Edition.